You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 51. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk with Irene Schmale about Pliopleistocene primates and climate change.
Let's dig a little deeper.
Everyone, welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 51. We are here today with Irene Schmale, and she is a fellow graduate student with me here at Arizona State University, and she works in the Institute of Human Origin and does some really interesting research with Pliopleistocene primates and what we can learn about early hominids by studying non-hominid primates. And rather than interrogate her privately about her research so I could understand what she does, I decided instead I would coerce her into coming on the podcast and publicly interrogate her. So welcome to the show, Irene, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I always love to talk about den monkeys.
Well, can you give us a little short overview about just what your research is? And then we'll dive deeper and ask you tons of probing questions.
So I'm a graduate student right now working on my dissertation research, and I'm interested in the evolution of old world monkeys that are scientifically known as cercopithecid primates, but that's a boring name. So old world monkeys, like humans, we see this pattern of evolution over the Pliocene and Pleistocene. So starting around 5 million years ago, where we have a lot of species sort of expanding out, and then eventually they all go extinct and die off. So it sort of the same pattern that we see in hominins. And I'm interested in understanding how these primates were able to coexist on the landscape and how they were able to survive or not survive climate change and what that can tell us potentially about hominin evolution.
That's really cool. So when you say old world primate, what is the difference between an old world and a new world primate? Just for those of us who see monkeys in zoos, and that's basically the end of our knowledge.
And let's also describe for our listeners who may not be aware, what do you mean by old world and new world?
So traditionally, the old world would be considered the continents of Europe, Africa, and Asia, as opposed to the new world, which would be North and South America. And so primates that come from the new world are things like you might have seen capuchin monkeys, you know, the little organ grinder monkeys, howler monkeys. And these are a distinct radiation from what happened in the old world. So old world monkeys and apes are things, obviously, you know, apes are chimps, orangs, gorillas. And old world monkeys are things like baboons, leaf-eating monkeys, some of the other, you know, sort of classical, when you think of a monkey, that's what you think of type of monkey. And so old world monkeys are most closely related to apes. So humans are closely related to chimps and other great apes. And then our sort of next closest relative would be old world monkeys.
So you are technically a paleoanthropologist.
Correct.
And you've told me before that while you belong in our department, you also belong more closely in some of the biology and geology style departments. Can you kind of go into that a little bit more about like what paleoanthropology is and how you both conform and diverge from this standard definition?
So I'm sure your listeners know what anthropology is, the study of humans, especially human culture and modern humans, as opposed to something like paleontology, which would be the study of fossil mammals, dinosaurs, other fossil animals. And so the type of research I do is studying fossil humans, and it sort of falls on that edge of should belong in something like a paleontology department, studying biology and fossil animals and the geology that goes with them. But because we study humans, we've sort of been grandfathered into anthropology departments, and so we combine it and say paleoanthropology.
Nice.
Okay. How did you get interested in paleoanthropology? What made you choose this field of study?
So I actually, as an undergrad, I wanted to become an underwater archaeologist. And to do that, I had to get a degree in archaeology. And so I needed to go on a field school. And for fun, I thought I would go on a paleoanthropology field school. And that was sort of a life-changing experience of, I actually really love doing this. I like to tell people that when I was there, I broke a hominin fossil tooth. Brachypteranthropus molar. And so I now like to think that I need to make up for that by spending the rest of my career studying these animals to understand them better.
A little bit vigorous with a pickaxe, were you?
Yep, hammer and chisel. That's exactly what it was.
Nice. That's kind of, I almost went down that route. I did a field school in Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, we didn't find any hominid stuff, unfortunately, but we found a lot of extinct alligator and hippo things, mm-hmm. but no hominid stuff, sadly. So, but it is a great field. I actually applied to ASU for graduate school when I was like a junior in college, and I was grossly underqualified for it. So they, you know, just stamped a smiley face on it and sent it back.
Oh, no.
You got the good effort sticker and.
Yeah. Yeah. They like put a gold star on there. It was like, maybe next time. Yeah. So anyway, that's really cool. Where's your research going right now? Like your dissertation, what are the big questions you're trying to answer?
So what I'm trying to answer is how cercopithecid communities, old world monkey communities, evolve as a whole. So instead of doing the thing where we would traditionally look at the evolutionary trajectory of one species or try to understand the ecology of one species through time, I'm interested in how groups of primate fossil populations evolve together through time. So things like changing their diet in response to competition when another primate moves into the region, or how they might go extinct locally as the climate changes or be replaced by a different primate species.
Since you're studying it in this way, let's step it back just a little bit too. And I'm not sure if you know this, but do we know when genetically old world and new world monkeys split off from each other? Presumably it was sometime around when the continents were still attached.
Yeah. So new world monkeys, I'm going to get the molecular dates wrong if I say it. I want to say it's something like 40 million, but it's probably not.
Okay.
But yeah, so new world monkeys diverged from the rest of the old world primates, probably through a rafting event to get to the new world. That's why old world monkeys are, in fact, more closely related to apes, share a common ancestor, okay. I want to say 20 something million years ago. So yeah, new world monkeys are a totally.
What's a rafting event? Because that sounds amazing. And I'm hoping it's what I'm envisioning, which is like a monkey on a board floating across the ocean.
So there is some debate as to how New World monkeys got to the New World, right? They could have crossed some sort of land bridge through Antarctica or wherever. One of the major theories, which I personally sort of love, is that there was probably an event where, say, a whole bunch of trees got washed out to sea in a monsoon or tsunami event that happened to have primates and insects on it. And so the primates were able to eat the insects and magically survive, you know, just drifting across the oceans until they made it to South America.
Okay, so my image is pretty...
So your image is pretty accurate.
I think I support that theory based on the beauty of the imagery of it. So
it was like a couple. It was like a male and female couple. They were just off on some romantic rafting event and ended up in South America.
Yep.
Okay, sounds good. That's a solid theory.
This is just throwing me back to our last interview where we were talking about the Salutrian.
Right?
Yeah.
So many unanswered questions. Yep. That's right.
Why is studying these non-human primates interesting? I mean, obviously, they're part of an important ecosystem. But why is that something that's of interest to people? Like, why does this matter, I guess?
Well, why it matters to me, I think, is that some of these primates are maybe better models for understanding human evolution than modern humans are. So modern humans, while I love them and everything that they do, they're sort of messy because we have this thing called culture that lets us adapt to new environments and lets us sort of evolve without physically evolving. So when we're talking about the origins of our species and, you know, how do primates respond to, things like climate change or predation or competition, I don't think really look at modern humans as an appropriate model for what's happening 4 and 5 million years ago. And so non-human primates are the next ideal thing to study because they're very similar to what we are, but they don't have that cultural complexity that modern humans do.
So this is actually interesting because it gets back to Chris and I have had some other interviews with people who study early hominids, and we always end up asking them questions that are, I would say, anthropologically loaded and often kind of about culture in a way. So part of what you're saying is this is going to get you in trouble with everybody who studies, you know, early hominids, obviously, is that these early hominid groups didn't necessarily have culture in the way we understand it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that could be controversial. I hope I don't get in too much trouble. So there, we do know that, for example, things like chimpanzees and orangs maybe do, you know, they have material culture. They do use stone tools. Chimpanzees especially, there are some sort of inherited cultural aspects where particular groups will have a certain behavior or a certain tool use. And so it's not that they don't have culture, but they don't have sort of the complex culture that we see in modern humans where you have these really intense material products that are passed down through generation and the sort of learning that is involved in that extended childhood period that you would need to be able to learn how to make complex tools to do what humans do today.
Okay.
As we know, humans and non-human primates have a common ancestor. And I think one thing that a lot of people get confused by that don't study this topic is they're like, how do I evolve from a monkey? But we didn't evolve from monkeys. We monkeys and humans evolved from the same thing, right? Apes and humans evolved from the from a common ancestor. So with the human evolutionary tree somewhat in flux a lot of times, I mean, we keep nailing it down, you know, farther and farther as we do more research, but there's still a lot of unanswered questions there. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering the types of non-human primates that you're investigating to answer some questions about, you know, humanity. How do you think that's, you know, affects how we look at humanity based on the types of primates that you're looking at? Like, for example, if you're looking at non-human primates from, say, a million years ago, that's still quite distant from where we diverged from them genetically. So culturally, you know, obviously non-human primates evolved different cultural adaptations than humans did. So I'm just trying to figure out how you're condensed, you know, making those two similar. I'm not saying this right at all. I'm trying to figure out how you're correlating one with the other with your studies. What do we
yeah,
learn?
So that is a great question. One of the reasons that I study old world monkeys is partly an issue of convenience because we have a really great fossil record mm-hmm. of old world monkeys. Chimpanzees, you know, obviously are the closest human ancestor. They have a lot of things in common with humans. We only have, as far as I'm aware, a single chimpanzee fossil from maybe 12,000 years ago. And so if we really want to understand how humans were evolving through time, and especially with a lot of the new ideas about how climate might have affected that, old world monkeys are ideal because they're sort of evolving in parallel over the same time scale and in response to the same geological and climatic events. So even if they end up doing something different, which I think is very possible that monkeys are adapting in different ways than fossil hominins were, we can still sort of look at the timing of evolutionary events and the pacing of that, and then sort of understanding those parallel trends rather than making a direct comparison between monkeys and humans.
So part of that would be maybe if as we're looking at these evolutionary trends with old world primates, maybe they line up some with some of the evolutionary patterns with hominids. So that would tell us like, oh, they're climactic factors or environment. Like there's certain factors that are universally creating these evolutionary moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my favorite example of this would be that, so we know humans and chimps share a last common ancestor maybe 7 to 8 million years ago, based both on genetics and fossil evidence. And modern baboons share a last common ancestor with other old world monkeys, the guenons, around maybe 7 to 8 million years ago, based on fossil and molecular evidence. And at the same time that humans are sort of coming out of the trees and becoming terrestrial and changing their diets, baboons are doing a similar thing of coming out of the trees, becoming more terrestrial and changing their diets. And so, yes, that's exactly why I think that they're sort of a great study organism for understanding humans.
You know, if I were to just sit back and just guess, I would assume that the diets of early humans and or at least early anatomically modern humans and their predecessors, I would assume their diets with old world monkeys would have been really similar just because of where they live and what's available. When do we think that their diets started to diverge in a more, I guess, discernible way in the fossil record?
So I would say that the one probably big dietary shift we see in fossil hominins would be the incorporation of more meat into the diet, which is something that old world monkeys never really achieve. They do eat some meat, but not to the extent that humans do. Obviously, there's a lot of debate on that, whether or not that starts at, you know, the origins of stone tools. Personally, I would say that that probably doesn't happen until later in the genus Homo. Certainly, we know that Neanderthals and modern Homo sapiens incorporate a lot of meat into their diets. So I would argue that that probably happened maybe in the past 1 to 2 million years, but definitely not as far back as 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm wondering, after reading your the summary of your dissertation research that you sent over to us, you studied a lot about teeth. And just for our listeners, I want to talk about teeth a little bit. What is special about teeth in the fossil record? Because, you know, in case people don't know, fossils, you know, bones, I mean, there's no bone material left. It's rock, you know, it's mineralized bone that's been, you know, it's turned into rock. When I held up that ridiculous hippo femur that we dug up in Olduvai Gorge, I mean, it was like 40 pounds. It was a huge rock. And so what's special about teeth in the fossil record?
So teeth are sort of the best thing that we ever get in the fossil record. Even in a living human, for the most part, your teeth are almost entirely rock already. There's not a lot of organic material in teeth, as opposed to bone, which has a lot more organic material. And so throughout the fossilization process, all of the things that it takes to convert organic material into rock and mineral, and as bones get sort of lost and weathered along the way, it just happens that teeth are much more likely to get preserved than fossil bones. And on a secondary level, because we use teeth to chew food, they sort of serve a functional purpose, which means when we find a tooth in the fossil record, we can sort of instantly understand something about what that animal was eating and how they were therefore finding, you know, energy and resources on the landscape in a way that like a femur just tells you that that animal walked somehow.
All right. Well, we are really close to our first break, so I think we're going to do that now. We'll come back on the other side of the break and keep talking with Irene about, you know, monkeys and humans. Back in a second.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to episode 51 with Irene Schmale and People and Primates. Though we are primates, so I guess that's not a really accurate. Well then, on that note, so we were just talking about teeth and the like fossil teeth and their value. So can you tell us a little bit about how you're using primate or old world monkey teeth in your research? Sorry, let me be a little more accurate since you're not using primate teeth.
Well, I am. I'm just not using human teeth. Yeah. So basically what I'm trying to do is using teeth to sort of quantify the relationship between monkeys and monkey diet and their environment. We know that, for example, colobine monkeys that eat a lot of leaves need really tall and sharp teeth in order to cut those leafy foods down. We know that baboons that maybe grind more hard objects have flatter teeth that they use and thick enamel that they use to sort of grind nuts and seeds and things. And so what I'm sort of doing is right now using modern museum collections of primates that we know come from one site, measuring all of their teeth and then doing a bunch of fancy statistics on those to sort of build a model of where they sit in this ecological space. So sort of a quantification of, you know, how tall and pointy teeth are versus how round and flat they are, and seeing how the space that is occupied by all of those primates living together at one site relates to the sort of environmental availability of things at that site. So we would see that monkey communities that come from the open savanna don't have the types of teeth that are, you know, tall and cuspy and used for shearing leaves, because there's not that many trees and leaves to eat in an open savanna environment. And so I've been building this model of understanding how monkeys sort of maximize the amount of foods that they can eat based on what their teeth look like. And then ultimately sort of being able to link that with modern climatic and environmental factors in order to then look at what fossil monkeys were doing and say, okay, are fossil monkeys eating similar types of foods, or were they capable of eating similar types of foods because they have the same types of teeth? Or were they doing something that's different from what we see in modern monkeys? And if that's the case, sort of what direction is it in? Does it look like they were eating more types of leafy foods, more types of hard foods? Or do their teeth look like nothing we've ever seen before?
So as you're learning about these things that these old world monkeys would eat, are you learning about it in the general sense of categories of food, or are you adding some information to what we know about the paleo environments of those areas, or are you bringing in other research about the paleo environments?
So for what I'm doing, I'm using the modern monkeys to reconstruct the diets, and then comparing those with modern monkeys, but also bringing in other aspects of paleoenvironmental reconstruction. So climatic reconstruction of things like temperature and rainfall patterns, and aspects of other animals in the community that are used to reconstruct what sorts of plants and things would have been on the environment. So I guess sort of coming at it from both ends of understanding how the diet relates to the environment in modern monkeys, and then seeing if that relationship holds in the past.
Okay.
So as part of this, so say you were studying fossilized old world monkeys from an area that currently is savanna, but you're seeing that they have a lot of sharp pointy teeth.
Right.
So essentially what that's telling you is about how the landscape and environment has changed since the Pleistocene.
Yes. And then for an example like that, I would then line it up and say, hey, look, we have, you know, carbon isotope data from bovids and other animals, you know, antelopes and pigs. And we have this geological data on what we think the, you know, lake or river system might have been like. And that confirms that probably we're looking at a more wooded treed environment. And so, yeah, looking at what I think the monkeys are doing and then saying, yes, this lines up with everything else that people are saying about this environment. And so far it's been lining up.
You know, I'm wondering this seemingly trend in research these days about looking at kind of big picture stuff. You know, you're talking about environment. You're not talking about one particular species at one particular point in time. Is this really where research is going? And what I'm thinking of is when I did work through Olduvai Gorge, like over 10 years ago, it was, I heard about later on Rutgers University working out there on what they call the OLAP project, the Olduvai Landscape Paleoanthropology Project, I think it was called. And their thesis was the leakies worked Olduvai Gorge vertically. They knew at every step in time, you know, they looked at these chunks of time vertically from present to 2 million years, which is what Olduvai Gorge goes back to. And they knew all those, but we didn't know anything about the landscape at each one of those levels. So they were digging around different spots in the gorge at known time spans between the basalt layers and saying, okay, well, what does this landscape look like? What are the other animals? What are the plants? What are those things? When you're doing your research, is it becoming easier to find out information about these landscape projects, or are you having to cobble together hundreds and hundreds of resources to really reinvent the landscape and study it?
For the most part, I'm lucky that a lot of that work has been done.
Nice.
So a lot of the researchers at Arizona State here, including several of my colleagues, have. So my advisor, Kay Reed, has done a lot of work using paleoecology and looking at the entire mammal community to understand what fossil environments would look like. And we've had two graduate students who recently defended, one looking at antelope and one looking at pigs, and using those animals to reconstruct the environment, along with a lot of the recent trends using say carbon isotope analysis, and especially geological data So for the most part, there's a lot of information out there that I'm heavily relying on for that aspect.
Yeah, it seems like somebody like you that's researching this, and probably your colleagues as well, can look at these landscapes at a certain time frame and just see it like a puzzle piece with missing pieces. And can you tell me what some of the maybe big missing pieces are that you're aware of? Like where are people not researching yet? You know, what are we lacking in information in certain areas, if you know that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably a huge question.
That is a good question. I think a large part of it is like there are things that we would love to know, but we just don't have the methods yet, or we don't have the preservation and the fossil record yet to really understand. Mm-hmm. So, for example, part of my dissertation project is I want to compare South African fossil sites to East African fossil sites. And so East African fossil sites are these really nice, usually, you know, lake or river deposits. They're sort of nicely stratified. We have volcanoes that put down nice ash layers so we can date them. And in South Africa, we have cave deposits where sort of everything gets washed into a cave and you're not really sure how old things are or, you know, where on the landscape and when they might have come in. And so there are some things like that where I don't actually know if we'll ever be able to know as much about, say, you know, the exact timing of when things were put down in South Africa. So I guess that would be a big missing, you know, puzzle piece, but I don't know if we could ever get that puzzle piece. One thing I will say, I think would be a great missing puzzle piece would actually be to have more fossil work on the west coast of Africa, in places like Angola, where we know that there are fossil deposits, just to sort of have a better understanding now of what is happening, not just in these very limited sites in East and South Africa, but do we have patterns that span the rest of the continent? And we do know, because we start to have fossil sites in North Africa, some of the stuff coming out of Chad that, you know, obviously human evolution isn't limited to East and South Africa, but obviously that's where all the research is happening now. So,
yeah. Is it just that nobody's working in those areas, or are they politically unstable? What's going on?
Yes. It's
all the above.
Yeah. So Angola in particular, that's been a politically unstable issue since the civil war. So there was research that was done in Angola, which is how we know that there are fossil deposits, but obviously research stopped there for a while and people haven't gone back. And then for the most part, the rest of West Africa right now is under a rainforest or, you know, under agricultural zones that aren't really the best for going out and doing a field season.
Right.
You can't just walk around and pick up a piece of bone off the ground there.
Yeah. Okay.
So this extensive fossil record that, you know, you are working with and other people who are studying kind of the Pleistocene environment, where is that coming from? I mean, are people going out and intentionally looking for these non-hominid fossils and other data? Is it partly that when you're searching for hominid fossils, you know, you find this hippo leg and like you find all these other things during the course of certain types of research. And then over time, as we've been studying hominids, we've been collecting all this additional data. And now we're starting to get interested in it and investigate sort of this larger landscape.
Yes. So for the most part, a lot of these materials were collected by people who were going out and looking for fossil hominins. And then along the way, like, oh, here's a nice pig tooth. Let's pick up the pig tooth. So for the most part, a lot of my research and a lot of what other people are doing now isn't directly going out and doing field work. We still do a lot of field work, but a lot of it is going back to these large museum collections and saying, hey, we have all of these, you know, pieces that are here. What can we do with them that we haven't been able to do before? And, you know, understand better all the little fragments that got picked up and then ignored for 20 years because we were just looking at what the humans were doing.
So, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the overall value. I mean, when we're studying, can you talk a little bit more detail about why there is such a value in studying these let's face it, as humans, we're very egocentric. And really what we want to understand is our own evolutionary past. And so, you know, like, oh, this is really nice. These old world monkeys. But, you know, why is reconstructing this environment so important and, you know, kind of a key issue maybe to understanding our own evolutionary past?
I mean, I think one of the sort of the big things that paleoanthropology has been moving towards in the past, you know, decade or so, is that evolution doesn't happen in a box, right? We're not just, you know, every day gradually moving towards something. There need to be factors that are sort of driving animals to adapt in certain ways. And if we want to understand those factors, we can't just look at the one species that is adapting, because we won't sort of know what those external pressures are. And that's why, you know, studying the other animals on the landscape and saying, okay, what is the landscape? If we're talking about when humans start hunting and things, what sorts of carnivores are on the landscape that they might be competing with? What sorts of prey animals are out there on the landscape that they might have been hunting? And how would that have driven, you know, whether or not they used certain tool types or certain hunting strategies? And so that's why I think we have started to shift this focus towards non-human animals, is to figure out what are the potential pressures that could be driving human evolution. And then we can go back and look at the human hominin fossils themselves and say, okay, does this match with our expectations or not?
Okay.
You know, that made me think of a question I don't think I've ever thought of before, is, you know, when you look back 6-7 million years ago, when early hominids started diverging from other primates, do we have any fossil evidence, any sites where you have this commingling of these diverging species, or did they just start diverging from each other and then pretty much stuck to their own little groups? I never really thought about that before.
For like our last common ancestor?
Yeah, I guess what I mean is, you know, as they started to diverge, probably maybe like a million years after they genetically diverged, so maybe 5 to 6 million years ago, or even more recent, did early hominids that are on the human line, were they mingling? Do we have any evidence of them mingling, or I don't know if they would have really kept other things as pets. We didn't really have that concept. You know, they were domesticated monkeys, but at least not yet. But I'm just wondering, did we find those two in association on sites? Like maybe they were, you know, eating together or something like that. I have no idea. I'm just trying to think, has this ever been found?
Yeah, I mean, that's another one of these great sort of questions that people are exploring. Again, this is sort of a hard thing to study in the fossil record. What we do have is, we have evidence of different hominin species that were coexisting at the same time. So this could be sort of temporally, things like, we know that the robust Australopiths were coexisting with gracile Australopiths, so the Paranthropus and Australopithecus. Mm-hmm. We now have some evidence from East Africa that species that had the divergent big toe, so maybe we're more arboreal, we're still surviving and living on the landscape at the same time as species like Australopithecus that had the, you know, human style of big toe and terrestrial locomotion. So unfortunately, I don't know that we can ever say for sure, like, oh, they were definitely like coexisting and interacted on the landscape, but we could probably say there's definitely a possibility that we have, you know, multiple species of things that are ranging from arboreal to terrestrial, or having different diets in the case of Paranthropus and Australopithecus, that did probably inhabit the same environments and therefore had a lot of potential for interaction.
So, okay, going back to what we were just talking about, this idea that there are these, you know, arboreal and terrestrial and all of these different early primates and hominins all interacting, how do you break this apart? Like, how do you decide what things are hominid and what things are just sort of generic primate box A? Like, I mean, this is, because it seems like there's sort of this gradient, right? Like, as we evolve, different traits exist and disappear and change. And they are, you know, this, there's a generic collection of primate traits. And so how do you start to separate and say, okay, this is a primate, this is a hominid, especially when you're just looking at these fossils in museums and then how do you do your job?
How do I do my job? My job is to identify just the monkey teeth. How we would identify fossil hominins is we are lucky. We do have some, you know, really nicely preserved specimens where we have teeth and skulls and parts of the legs and other parts of the body. And so it's all of those things that you probably studied in Intro to Biological Anthropology and then forgot about. But we do have evidence that, so all hominins, even the ones that still have some arboreal locomotion, are more adapted to upright bipedalism. So they have that shift in the foramen magnum position, indicating that they're walking upright instead of walking on all fours. We see changes in, say, the canine and parts of the teeth morphology, indicating maybe a change in sort of the social structure or dental function in these hominins. And so then a large part of it is, you know, once we know, okay, this is a fossil hominin and these are these traits, if we find another fossil that looks like it and it's not the same species, but we can say, okay, you know, it has all of these traits and therefore it's more likely a hominin than a chimpanzee. And again, because we don't have any fossil chimps or chimp-related things, it's sort of easy to say, well, these all look like hominins. But yeah, they do. It's especially the sort of the upright locomotion is a big, clear, you don't get chimps walking on two legs ever.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay. Well, that is the end of the segment. So let's take a break and come back and solve all the questions and complete your research in 20 minutes. Okay. Back in a second.
Tired of the webinars and training offered by the big organizations not being free for members and not really covering what we need? Team Black has the answers. Check out arccert.black/main for our upcoming webinar schedule. All of our webinars happen once a month and seating is limited. Learn everything from field tech basics to drones to digital workflows. We have more classes coming online every month. Classes are always 1 hour and cost just $20. Classes like building a CV and getting a job are always free. That's right. We'll help you get a job, then we'll be here when you want to level up your skills. If you are a professional subscriber to the APN at arcpodnet.com/members, then you get all of Team Black's offerings for free as part of your membership. We have Team Black memberships coming that will give the same for the APN. So $20 a month gets you all the APN swag and extras, plus free training from Team Black. So check out arccert.black for more information and level up your skill set today. That's arccert.black. Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 51. So, Irene, let's start wrapping this up a little bit. Where are you going to go? We've already talked about your research and what you're doing and what you're hoping to discover. Where are you going after you finish your dissertation? I suppose it depends on where you end up getting a job and working, but where do you want your research to go? Are you going to continue studying these non-human primates, these old world monkeys, or do you want to tackle other things in a similar vein?
I think personally that I love fossil monkeys. I'm definitely going to stick with fossil monkeys. One of the things that I really want to do, eventually with my research is, like I mentioned, I have collaborators at ASU and elsewhere that are looking at these patterns in other mammals. And I would really love to get together and do a huge collaboration with people who study all of, you know, the hominin and non-hominin mammals that are evolving over the Pleistocene. And build a really complete model of what these mammal communities looked like and how they were changing through time, and how ultimately, you know, we go from the sort of fossil communities and the fossil mammals that we see to the ones that we see today. And then eventually maybe be able to predict, you know, as we're looking at, you know, climate change and anthropogenic impacts, how will those communities that exist today sort of continue forward into the future? Because we know from ecological research that, you know, communities aren't just one species, and it's not just like only the monkeys in the community. There are tons of complex interactions between the monkeys and the leopards that eat the monkeys and the plants that the monkeys eat. And so really being able to put everything together with experts who study all of those other animals, I think that would be my ideal goal, which would probably take the rest of my life and then maybe a little more.
But I mean, that sounds really interesting. It's sort of creating, I mean, when you watch documentaries or people sort of artists recreate these worlds. And so what you're saying is really using the evidence that we actually have to create this holistic environment and then be able to say, well, here's how it changes. This plant drops out. this primate drops out and this new one appears, and show that ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I think would be cool.
I mean, that would be really fun. I'd then want to go back and live in it for a while, like get to wander around.
Oh no, there are big, carnivores out there. You do not want to run into those guys on the landscape.
Nice. So looking at your research, Irene, a lot of times when we are studying stuff in the past, it's to understand the present and the future and where we're going to go, how we can learn from those lessons that we learned in the past. And we have a lot of data across the planet about climate change. Obviously, the climate is a very dynamic thing, and it's been changing throughout time. I mean, there's been thousands of ice ages, and we've been really hot, we've been really cold, and everything in between, and species seem to somehow make it work, or they don't make it work, and they die off and go away. So what kind of, I guess, modern parallels can you make to our climate change that we're experiencing now, to climate change that you've seen in the past in these paleo environments?
Well, one thing I would say, first of all, is that modern climate change is happening much more rapidly than what we see in the past.
Right.
And one of the things that I find interesting is that when we start to see climate fluctuations over the past 1 to 2 million years with the advent of the genus Homo, that's when we start to see the modern baboon radiation appear. So savanna baboons, which were able to survive all of the climate fluctuations of the late Pleistocene, at the same time that all of these other fossil baboons were going extinct. And those species are the ones today that have been the most able to adapt to human environments. So baboons, mm-hmm. And macaques today are sort of seen as like rats of the primate world. They live in human environments. They, you know, steal Coca-Cola bottles from tourists, and they've sort of been able to overrun human landscapes in a way that other primates and many other mammals have not been able to do. And so one of my ultimate questions is, you know, what is it about these animals that were able to survive past climate change that might make them more resilient to modern climate and anthropogenic change? And also, when we see extinction events in the past, can we look at, you know, is it the specialist species that are going first? So an animal that has a specific diet that tends to die off first and then is followed by all of the other species. I can't give you an answer yet, but that would be one thing I want to look at is, can we see the, you know, these patterns of early extinctions that are followed by later extinctions, and then look at the primates that are going extinct today and figure out, you know, what does this mean for the rest of that community? Or maybe it'll be like baboons surviving.
Hey, there you go.
We will become the rats of the future species.
Yeah.
Nice. You know, that makes me think, I'm curious about your thoughts on this, is there sort of a formula we can come with it? Like, I know climate change is obviously happening rapidly right now, more rapidly than it probably has, you know, since the planet was covered in volcanoes when climate change was really going nuts. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if there's a rate of genetic change that we can correlate with the rate of climatic change and say, listen, if the climate changes this fast, we hit this threshold where species just can't change fast enough unless they already have a special adaptation for that climate and they're just not going to make it. Have you heard of anything like that, or what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah. So there definitely is. The genetic evidence for change is usually based on generational rate. So we know that small animals can adapt faster than big animals.
Right.
And then the jury seems to be out on whether or not specialist species actually adapt faster or slower than generalist species. But it does seem, as far as I'm aware from other research, that when you line those things up, we look at the species that are most endangered today, it's large-bodied animals that have those slower generation times and can't adapt as fast. And then, you know, specialist animals that only eat one resource. And so if that resource gets lost, they're just not reproducing enough to actually adapt in time.
Well, it's weird too, because it depends on the environment animals live in too, because some aquatic animals haven't changed in millions of years, like sharks, you know, but then also some slightly more amphibious ones like crocodiles too. I mean, crocodiles are virtually identical except for a size change for millions and millions and millions of years. So, and then of course the cockroach, but they have a high rate of reproduction. Yeah. Which is surprising that since they have such a high rate of reproduction that they haven't really changed that much either. What's up with cockroaches? I don't know.
I guess if you find a winning strategy, like you don't change your winning strategy, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true. So, yeah.
I mean, that kind of comes to us too. I mean, it seems like hominids evolved, figured out a winning strategy, spread like cockroaches, spread across the planet. But so when you're looking at these early environments, you're looking at early hominids, you're looking at early primates, and you're seeing these moments when maybe climactic factors are forcing evolutionary shifts or jumps or developments. I mean, do you envision, this is pushing you real far. Do you envision that potentially, because it seems like evolutionarily we have been stable for a while now, that climate change that we've created might actually force us into a next evolutionary step?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say no. I think that, first of all, we have been evolving, even though it doesn't look like it. We've just been evolving culturally. Mm. So in terms of our morphological and our genetic traits, you know, those have been fairly stable. You know, we still are this sort of, you know, terrestrial, generalist, omnivore species. But we've adapted all of these different, you know, material culture things to allow us to survive in different environments. And so I would say that, you know, with future climate change, we won't maybe physically adapt. We'll just adapt with technology instead, which is what we've been doing for the past 100,000 years or so.
Nice. Okay. No, that makes sense.
Also, we tend to, as we gain more knowledge of this stuff, I hear people say this all the time. They're like, oh, humans aren't really evolving anymore because blah, blah, blah. I was like, listen, you know, we've only been culturally aware of the fact that evolution's even a thing, or science, or the fact that we're human, you know, for like a few tens of thousands of years, right? And probably way less than that. And evolution takes place on a, you know, multi hundreds of thousands of years time frame. So, you know, we're not going to grow another arm like next year, because that's lets us get on more social media devices, right? So, I know.
As so, twins, if I could grow a third arm, I would just be really excited about it.
Yeah,
I know.
I really just wanted to find out that, you know, in like 1,000 years, humans will have these cool new evolutionary traits.
Oh, well, we might have lost our third molars if you want something solid there. Oh, great. Because we don't use those anymore.
Mm. That's true. A lot of people don't even have them, really. Yeah. So I guess I'll take that as our next evolutionary jump.
But there usually has to be some reproductive advantage in an evolutionary trait for it to really propagate through the system, right? So the molars, while we don't really use them anymore, and things like you can have your appendix taken out and other things like that, there's just no advantage to having that done, right? I don't have the ladies knocking down my door because I lost my molars. You know what I'm saying? So,
well,
you know,
but
passing on those traits.
Yeah, but I would say that, you know, several thousand years ago, you needed that third molar because otherwise your teeth were going to wear down and you wouldn't be able to eat anything and you would die of starvation.
Right.
Now that's not a problem. So your body's like, well, why am I going to spend energy making an extra tooth if I could spend that energy growing up faster?
Indeed. So we've already kind of touched on this a little bit, but, you know, what are some of your immediate next questions that you want to answer? I know when you're in dissertation land, you're just like totally hyper-focused, but let's assume you finish that glory days, you're out. What is the very next thing? If your position and time and money were no issue, what is the very next thing you would want to study?
If nothing was an issue, I would love to do field work in West Africa and figure out what is going on over there. And again, that's just because we know these patterns of species moving between East and South Africa. We know there are fossil monkeys from parts of Angola. We don't have fossil hominins there yet, but I suspect that that's maybe just because we haven't been looking for them. So my sort of next question would be, if we could find something out there, what is happening between East and South Africa? Do we have a lot of species exchanges between these two regions, as opposed to, you know, our species just evolving locally and converging on a morphology? If we're looking at, again, Paranthropus and Australopithecus, that classic, you know, big skeleton versus the smaller one. And I really do think that, you know, I know fieldwork is sort of fading. We have huge museum collections for the hominin fossil record, but that is one place that I think, you know, should have some more research done, and I would love to do it. situations were different.
Nice. Well, things change. So, yeah. You know, I want to go back to, you know, in the last few minutes of this, I want to go back to teeth real quick because there was something I forgot to ask for our listeners. So you know a lot about the paleo environment based on the shape or morphology of the teeth and what they were possibly eating. You know, you can look at the wear patterns and things like that and see how they were, you know, how they were living their day-to-day lives. But are these fossil teeth, and some of our listeners may be aware that you can kind of dig into these teeth and take a sample of them and really understand some of the exact types of classes of plants that they were eating. Are you able to do that with fossil teeth as well?
Yes. So when I mentioned the carbon isotope data earlier, that is right. That is one thing that does, you know, survive for millions of years. And so people have looked at carbon isotopes, and that's essentially the ratio of, you know, carbon 12 to 13, which is stable carbon, which indicates if an animal is eating more grass or more leafy and fruit material. And so we do know mm-hmm. that, say, modern baboons eat a mixed diet. We know that some fossil baboons ate only fruit and leaves. And we know that there are some fossil baboons that specialized on grass and those types of resources.
Right. So to be clear, you're not finding out exactly the species of plant or something like that, or tree or whatever that the animal's eating, but just mm-hmm. the type, the bigger picture.
Yeah. But, you know, we can combine that with teeth. So you imagine, you know, grass is sort of a tough leafy material. So you would need tall, pointy teeth to process grass. Mm. And so, you know, a grass eater might look like a leaf eater, but then if we add in, you know, the carbon isotope data, we can say, okay, this is a tall pointy teeth that mean grass, and these are tall pointy teeth that mean leaves.
Okay, so that then helps differentiate between like a savanna setting versus a forest setting, even if the teeth are essentially looking similar and looking the same.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sampling them, but other people have.
Yeah, for sure. Well, back to your research. I think one of my last questions is, you know, you start out with research questions. You start out with a hypothesis, and then you gather data and you try to answer those questions. Has anything in your research surprised you or gone a direction you didn't think it would go?
So one of the surprising findings from my pilot study was I was looking at modern primate communities in Africa and Asia. And a lot mm-hmm. of people, when they study old world monkeys, we go to Africa because there's a lot more old world monkeys in Africa. There's been a lot more research done there. The old world monkey communities in Asia, there's a lot fewer species. They haven't been as well studied, but, you know, they still don't seem to be as species rich and as diverse as the ones in Africa. But actually, when you look at sort of what the communities are doing, they seem to be occupying a similar amount of ecological space. And so to me, that was sort of surprising that even though we have fewer species and they're not as diverse, there aren't as many of them, they still seem to be doing the same thing. So they've sort of maximized what they're doing in the environment to the same degree that primates in Africa have, despite that sort of lower diversity overall.
It's interesting. Yeah. So does that partly mean that there's just larger numbers of each species? Does that make sense? Like the populations, you have X amount of space and it will host this amount of population. And mm-hmm. so individual species just have larger population numbers versus if you have lots of species, you might have fewer, like smaller population size.
Yeah. So it's probably a combination of, things like changes in population size. And we also know from a lot of the field studies on African monkeys that things like guenons, for example, will all eat fruit and leaves, but they'll do it at different levels in the canopy. So one will be at the top of the trees, one in the middle, and one at the bottom. And it seems that a lot of these primates in Asia are sort of, you know, that's your thing. You specialize in the entire tree, not just in one specific part of it.
Okay. I think my last question is there anything that you want to tell our listeners about your research or your conclusions or anything like that we didn't get to on this podcast?
Ooh, I wish I had more conclusions to share.
Hey, we'll bring you back in like 2 years when you've finished and defended. You can tell us what the end results were of all of this.
That sounds excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. Where are you? Because again, our listeners might not be familiar with what a PhD life cycle is like this. Where are you in your research phases? Yeah. Where are you in your PhD life cycle?
So I did a pilot study, which meant, you know, I got a small pot of money. I went to a few museums in the US and collected data on mm-hmm. modern communities. And then I have applied for several large grants to go to museums in Ethiopia, Kenya, and South Africa to look at the fossil monkey collections mm-hmm. there. So now I'm in the phase of waiting to get money to go to the museums to actually collect the fossil data. And then I'll write it all up and hopefully defend in a couple of years.
Excellent. Sounds good. And then hopefully somebody will go to these museums and, you know, 3D scan and do a bunch of stuff to these things. So we don't always have to go all the way to Kenya to do the research. That would be nice. But, you know, going to Kenya is pretty cool too.
I was going to say, I don't mind spending some extra time in Ethiopia.
Yeah, I would take that. Yeah. Or so nice. That, you know, yeah. when things happen, like the Brazil Museum burned down, we have all these things preserved in case of catastrophe.
Yes.
I think that is always mm-hmm. our greatest fear Good. As museum people.
Whew. Yes.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks again for inviting me.
Yeah, I just had to walk, you know, to a different building on campus and say, hey. So it wasn't a great trial. And
very coercive, yes.
It was wonderful to have you on the show today.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, thank you. And hopefully we can have, I mean, this is our second sort of human evolution based show in a row. And I love it. Not really human evolution. I guess the last one was more early humans in North America, but it's all kind of like origin stories to me. And I love that kind of stuff. So, you know, April, you're kind of in the Mecca for that sort of thing at Arizona State. And it's I hope we can get more people on like this. So that'd be great.
And if this topic really fascinated you and you have not been listening to our podcast for very long, last year we did an interview with Shara Bailey, who studies hominid teeth. And so mm-hmm. there's some overlap, and she is also an ASU alum. So I recommend that you hop backwards in time and take a listen to that interview. It's another great one. So.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, April, for setting this up. And thanks, Irene, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.